The doctor was bald and had an unusually small skull covered with white fluff, which reminded Rubashov of an ostrich.
"He says he's got toothache," said the old warder.
"Toothache," said the doctor. "Open your mouth."
Rubashov's tooth was not aching at the moment. He opened his mouth.
"You've got no teeth left at all on the left side of your upper jaw," said the doctor, probing with his finger.
And suddenly Rubashov became pale and had to lean against the wall.
"Oh, there it is," said the doctor. "The root of the right eye tooth is broken off and has remained in the jaw. Well, if you like, I can extract the root for you. We have, of course, no anaesthetics here."
Rubashov heard the doctor's voice through a mist. "Thank you," he said. "Not now." 3 days later, Rubashov was brought up for examination for the first time. It was 11 o'clock in the morning when they came to fetch him. They went the same way that he had gone when he went to see the doctor. Beyond the doctor's door was new ground for Rubashov. They passed a spiral staircase leading down into the depths. What was down there? Storerooms? Punishment cells? Rubashov tried to guess with the interest of the expert. He didn't like the look of that staircase. They crossed a narrow windowless courtyard. It was a blind shaft, rather dark, but over it hung the open sky. On the other side of the courtyard, the doors were no longer of concrete, but of painted wood. They stopped at the last door, at the end of the corridor. The warder knocked. Inside, someone was telephoning. A quiet voice called out, "Come in." The warder opened the door and shut it immediately behind Rubashov. Rubashov saw a desk. Behind it sat his old colleague and friend and former battalion commander, Ivanov. Rubashov stood at the door. "Ah, well, what a pleasant surprise," he said dryly. "Sit down," said Ivanov. He had risen. Standing, he was half a head taller than Rubashov. Then they both sat down, Ivanov behind the desk, Rubashov in front of it. His glance slid to Ivanov's right leg under the table.
"Oh, that's all right," said Ivanov. "Artificial leg with automatic joints and rustless chromium plating. I can swim, ride, drive a car, and dance."
Rubashov thought of his first visit to the military hospital after Ivanov's leg had been amputated. Ivanov had asked him to procure Veronal for him and had tried to prove that every man had a right to suicide. Rubashov had finally asked for time to reflect and had in the same night been transferred to another sector of the front. It was only years later he had met Ivanov again.
"I do not want you to be shot," Ivanov said slowly.
"Decent of you," said Rubashov.
"Why actually do you people intend to have me shot?"
Ivanov let a few seconds go by. He seemed to be searching for the exact words. Then he said,
"You distinguish between you people, meaning state and party, and I, meaning Nicholas Salmanovich Rubashov. That basically is why you are here."
Rubashov thought this over. It was as if Ivanov had hit a tuning fork to which his mind responded of its own accord. All he had believed in, fought for, and preached during the last 40 years swept through his mind. The individual was nothing, and the party was all. The branch which broke from the tree must wither.
"Your argument is anachronistic," Rubashov said. "As you quite rightly remarked, we were accustomed always to use the plural we and to avoid as far as possible the first person singular. I've rather lost the habit of that form of speech. You stick to it. But who is this we in whose name you speak today? It needs redefining, that's the point."
"Oh, entirely my own opinion," said Ivanov. "I'm glad we've reached the heart of the matter so soon. In other words, you are convinced that we, that's to say the party, the state, and the masses behind it, no longer represent the interests of the revolution, right?
I should leave the masses out of it, said Rubashov.
How do you mean?
Leave the masses out of it. You understand nothing about them, nor probably do I anymore. Once, when the great we still existed, we understood them as no one had ever understood them before. We had penetrated into their depths. We worked in the amorphous raw material of history itself. Without noticing it, Rubashov had taken a cigarette out of Ivanov's case, which lay open on the table. Ivanov bent forward and lit it for him.
And at that time, we were called the Party of the Plebs. We dug in the primeval mud of history, and there we found her laws. We knew more than men have ever known about mankind. And that's why our revolution succeeded. And now you've buried it all again.
Ivanov gave his aristocratic smile. You mean, therefore, that we, namely party and state, no longer represent the interests of the revolution, of the masses? Or, if you like, the progress of humanity, do you?
You've grasped it, said Rubashov.
When did you develop this opinion?
Fairly gradually, during the last few years.
Let me repeat my question in another form. For how long have you belonged to the organized opposition?
You know as well as I do that I never joined an oppositional organization.
Ivanov put a hand in a drawer and pulled out a bundle of files. Let's start with 1933, he suggested. Outbreak of the dictatorship and crushing of the party in the very country where victory seemed closest.
You are sent there illegally with the task of carrying through a purging and reorganization of the ranks.
Rubashov thought of Richard.
3 months later, you are arrested in that country. 2 years imprisonment. Behavior exemplary. Nothing can be proved against you. Release and triumphal return.
Ivanov paused, threw him a quick, delicate glance, and went on.
But after a fortnight, you were already applying for another mission abroad.
To Rubashov, it seemed that he smelt again the smell of the docks in the little port. Little Lurvy saluting with his pipe. He had hanged himself on a beam in his attic.
The mission successfully concluded, you were nominated leader of our trade delegation in Belgium.
Ivanov continued.
And this time, too, you carried out your duties irreproachably. But 6 months after you took over this post, your two closest collaborators, one of whom is your secretary, Alova, have to be recalled under the suspicion of oppositional conspiracy. This suspicion is confirmed by the inquiry. You are expected to disavow them publicly. You remain silent until the party sends you an ultimatum. Only then, when your head is at stake, do you condescend to give a declaration of loyalty, which automatically finishes Alova.
Her fate, you know. Yes, he knew her fate. Also Richard's fate. Also little Lurvy's.
Shall I read you the public statement you made at that time?
No, thank you.
As you remember, your statement, which one could also describe as a confession, ended with a sharp condemnation of the opposition and with a declaration of unconditional adhesion both to the policy of the party and to the person of number one.
Rubashov drew deeply on his cigarette. You know how that sort of statement is produced.
What I don't understand is this. You now openly admit that for years you've had the conviction that we were ruining the revolution. And in the very same breath, you deny that you belonged to the opposition or that you plotted against us.
Rubashov shrugged his shoulders. Perhaps I was too old and used up.
Ah, believe what you like, he said.
Now Ivanov lit another cigarette.
Do you really want me to believe that you sacrificed Alova only in order to save your own head?
Rubashov was silent.
You deny that you belonged to an oppositional group for which, in any case, we hold all the proofs.
Really?
If you have all the proofs, why do you need my confession? Proofs of what, by the way?
Amongst other things, proofs of a projected attempt on Number One's life. Again, there was a silence.
We have the confession of the man who was actually to commit the attempt at your instigation.
What's his name?
Oh, what an indiscreet question. Shall we call him X?
Ivanov smiled as he said this.
Do you remember the Veronal? Today it is you who are about to throw yourself headfirst down the precipice, but not with my help. You then convinced me that suicide was petty bourgeois romanticism. I shall see that you do not succeed in committing it.
Then we shall be quits. Rubashov passed a hand across his lips.
Really? The way in which you have examined me up to now seems to have exactly the opposite aim.
Ivanov smiled. Oh, you old fool. I was obliged to let you explode once, else you would have exploded at the wrong time.
Haven't you even noticed that I have no stenographer present? You're behaving like an infant, like a romantic infant. Now we are going to concoct a nice little confession, and that will be all for today.
Rubashov looked at him through his pince-nez.
And what would be in this confession?
Oh, in the confession will be written that you admit that since such and such a year you belong to such and such a group of the opposition, but that you emphatically deny having organized or planned an assassination, that, on the contrary, you withdrew from the group when you learned of the opposition's criminal and terrorist plans. Rubashov finally replied, if that's the object of all this talk, we can break it off immediately.
Oh, do let me finish what I was going to say. It is not yet decided whether your case should belong to Category A or Category P. Do you know the terms?
Rubashov nodded.
You begin to understand. A means administrative case. P means public trial. The great majority of political cases are tried administratively, that is to say, those who would be no good in a public trial.
Well, if you fall into Category A, you will be removed from my authority. The trial by the administrative board is secret and, as you know, somewhat summary. Rubashov again said nothing.
It all depends on you being classed in Category P and that the case remains in my hands. You know from what point of view those cases are selected and which are given a public trial. I have to prove a certain willingness on your part. And for that I need your deposition with a partial confession. If you make a partial confession, a basis is given for a more thorough examination. On this basis, I shall be able to obtain a confrontation. We will refute the worst points of the accusation and plead guilty within certain carefully defined limits. Even so, we shan't be able to make it cheaper than 20 years. And that means, in fact, 2 or 3 years, and then an amnesty. And in 5 years' time, you'll be back in the ring again. Now, have the goodness to think it over calmly before answering.
I've already thought it over.
I reject your proposition. Logically, you may be right, but I've had enough of this kind of logic. Be kind enough to have me taken back to my cell.
Oh, as you like. I didn't expect you'd agree at once. You have a fortnight.
Ask to be brought to me again when you've thought the matter over,
or send me a written declaration. Rubashov stood up. Ivanov also rose and said,
you wrote in your last article, only a few months ago,
that this next decade will decide the fate of the world in our era. Don't you want to be here for that?
Extract from the diary of N.S. Rubashov on the fifth day of imprisonment. The ultimate truth is penultimately always a falsehood. He who will be proved right in the end appears to be wrong and harmful before it. But who will be proved right? It will only be known later. Meanwhile, he is bound to act on credit and to sell his soul to the devil in the hope of history's absolution. It is said that number one has Machiavelli's prince lying permanently by his bedside, so he should. Since then, nothing really important has been said about the rules of political ethics. We were the first to replace the 19th century's liberal ethics of fair play by the revolutionary ethics of the 20th century. We were right. A revolution conducted according to the rules of cricket is an absurdity. Politics can be relatively fair in the breathing spaces of history. At its critical turning points, there is no other rule possible than the old one, that the end justifies the means. For the moment, we are thinking and acting on credit. As we have thrown overboard all conventions and rules of cricket morality, our sole guiding principle is that of consequent logic. We are under the terrible compulsion to follow our thought down to its final consequence and to act in accordance to it. We are sailing without ballast. Therefore, each touch on the helm is a matter of life and death. A short time ago, our leading agriculturalist, D, was shot with 30 of his collaborators because he maintained the opinion that nitrate artificial manure was superior to potash. Number one is all for potash. Therefore, D and the 30 had to be liquidated as saboteurs. In a nationally centralized agriculture, the choice between nitrate and potash is of enormous importance. It can decide the issue of the next war. If number one was in the right, history will absolve him, and the execution of the 31 men will be a mere bagatelle. If he was wrong, he who is in the wrong must pay. He who is in the right will be absolved. That is the law of historical credit. It was our law. We have learned history more thoroughly than others. We differ from all others in our logical consistency. We know that virtue doesn't matter to history, that crimes remain unpunished, but that every error has its consequences and venges itself unto the seventh generation. Therefore, we concentrated all our efforts on preventing error and destroying the very seeds of it. Each wrong idea we follow is a crime committed against future generations. Therefore, we have to punish wrong ideas as others punish crimes. With death. We were held for madmen because we followed every thought down to its final consequence and acted accordingly. We were compared to the Inquisition because, like them, we constantly felt in ourselves the whole weight of responsibility for the super-individual life to come. We resembled the great inquisitors in that we persecuted the seeds of evil not only in men's deeds, but in their thoughts. We admitted no private sphere, not even inside a man's skull. We lived under the compulsion of working things out to their final conclusions. And I was one of those. I have thought and acted as I had to. I destroyed people whom I was fond of and gave power to people I didn't like. History put me where I stood. I have exhausted the credit which she accorded me. If I was right, I have nothing to repent of. If wrong, I will pay. But how can the present decide what will be judged truth in the future? We are doing the work of prophets without their gift. We replaced vision by logical deduction.
And although we all started from the same point, we came to divergent conclusions. Proof, disprove, proof. And finally we had to return to faith. To axiomatic faith in the rightness of one's own individual reasoning. And that's the crucial point. We have thrown all ballast overboard. Only one anchor holds us. Faith in oneself. Well, number one has faith in himself. Tough, slow, sullen, unshakable. He has the most solid anchor chain of all. Mine's worn thin in the last few years. The fact is, I no longer believe in my own infallibility, and that is why I am lost. Diary extract ends. The day after the first hearing of Rubashov, the examining magistrate Ivanov and his colleague Gletkin were sitting in the canteen after dinner. Ivanov was tired. He'd undone the collar of his uniform. He poured out some wine and silently wondered at Gletkin, who sat straight up on his chair in his starched uniform, which creaked. He had not even taken off his revolver belt, although he must have been pretty tired too. Gletkin emptied his glass. The conspicuous scar on his clean-shaven head had reddened slightly. "What is to happen about Rubashov?" asked Gletkin. "Oh, he's in rather a bad way, but he is still as logical as ever, so he will capitulate." "That I don't believe." "When he has thought out everything to its logical conclusion, he will capitulate. Therefore, the essential thing is to leave him in peace and not to disturb him. I have allowed him paper, pencil, and cigarettes to accelerate the process of thought." Gletkin was unimpressed. "That will never make him give in," he retorted. "When Rubashov capitulates, it won't be out of cowardice, but by logic. It is no use trying the hard method with him. He is made out of a certain material which becomes the tougher the more you hammer on it." "That's just talk," said Gletkin. "Experience shows me that the resistance of the human nerve system is limited by nature." Gletkin stood up. "I recognize his past merits, but today he has become harmful and dangerous. I have given him a fortnight's time for reflection. Until that is over, I want him left in peace." Ivanov had spoken in his official tone. Gletkin was his subordinate. Since his first hearing, Rubashov's standard of life had improved miraculously. Already on the following morning, the old turnkey had brought him paper, pencil, soap, and a towel. At the same time, he gave Rubashov prison vouchers to the value of the cash he had had in his possession when he was arrested, and explained to him that he now had the right to order tobacco and extra food from the prisoner's canteen. The courtyard had been cleared of snow, and groups of prisoners walked round it for their daily exercise. It had been interrupted because of the snow. Only Hare-Lip and his companion had been allowed 10 minutes' walk daily, perhaps because of special doctor's orders. Every time they entered or left the yard, Hare-Lip had looked up to Rubashov's window. The gesture was so clear as to exclude any possibility of doubt. During the first few days, Rubashov had looked for familiar faces in the yard, but he saw none. That relieved him. For the moment, he wanted to avoid anything that might distract him from his task. His task was to work his thoughts to a conclusion, to come to terms with the past and future, with the living and the dead. He had still 10 days left of the term set by Ivanov. Rubashov had always believed that he knew himself rather well. Being without moral prejudice, he had no illusions about the phenomenon called the first person singular, and had taken it for granted, without particular emotion, that this phenomenon was endowed with certain impulses which people are generally reluctant to admit. Now, when he stood with his forehead against the window, or suddenly stopped on the third black tile of his floor, he made unexpected discoveries. He found out that those processes wrongly known as monologues are really dialogues of a special kind. Dialogues in which one partner remains silent while the other, against all grammatical rules, addresses him as I instead of you, in order to creep into his confidence and to fathom his intentions. But the silent partner just remains silent, shuns observation, and even refuses to be localized in time and space. Now, however, it seemed to Rubashov that the habitually silent partner spoke sometimes, without being addressed, and without any visible pretext. His voice sounded totally unfamiliar to Rubashov, who listened in honest wonder, and found that his own lips were moving. These experiences held nothing mystic or mysterious. They were of a quite concrete character. And by his observations, Rubashov gradually became convinced that there was a thoroughly tangible component in this first-person singular, which had remained silent throughout all these years, and now had started to speak. This discovery preoccupied Rubashov far more intensely than did the details of his interview with Ivanov. He considered it as settled that he would not accept Ivanov's proposals and that he would refuse to go on with the game. In consequence, he had only a limited time still to live, and this conviction formed the basis of his reflection. This reflection also had the form of a monologue, but along familiar lines. That newly discovered entity, the silent partner, did not participate in them. Direct questions and logical meditations did not induce it to speak. Its utterances occurred without visible cause, and strangely enough, always accompanied by a sharp attack of toothache. Its mental sphere seemed to be composed of such various and disconnected parts as the folded hands of the Pieta, or a particular sentence which Arlova had once spoken on a particular occasion. Rubashov tried to study this newly discovered entity very thoroughly during his wanderings through the cell. With the shyness of emphasizing the first-person singular customary in the party, he had christened it the grammatical fiction. He probably had only a few weeks left to live, and he did feel a compelling urge to clear up this matter, to think it to a logical conclusion. But the realm of the grammatical fiction seemed to begin just where the thinking to a conclusion ended. It was obviously an essential part of its being to remain out of the reach of logical thought, and then to take one unawares, as from an ambush, and attack one with daydreams and a toothache. Rubashov passed the entire seventh day of his imprisonment, the third after the first hearing, reliving a past period of his existence, namely his relation with the girl Arlova, who had been shot. Once more, Rubashov breathed the air of his erstwhile office in the trade delegation, which was filled with the peculiarly familiar odour of Arlova's big, well-formed and sluggish body. Once more he saw the curve of her bowed neck over the white blouse, bent over her notebook while he dictated, and her round eyes following his wanderings through the room in the intervals between the sentences. It was nearly a month before he first spoke to her in a conversational tone. He was tired by dictating and walking up and down and suddenly became aware of her silence. "Why do you never say anything, Comrade Arlova?" he asked, and sat down in the comfortable chair behind his writing desk. "If you like," she answered in her sleepy voice, "I will always repeat the last word of your sentence." After that unsuccessful attempt at conversation, another fortnight passed. One afternoon, to his own surprise, Rubashov stopped behind her chair, put both his hands lightly on her shoulders, and asked her whether she would go out with him in the evening. She nodded in silence and did not even turn her head. It was not a habit of Rubashov's to make frivolous jokes, but later, in the same night, he could not forbear from saying with a smile, "One would think you were still taking down dictation." The outline of her large, well-shaped breast seemed as familiar against the darkness of the room as though she had always been there. Only the earrings now lay flat on the pillow. Her eyes had the same expression as ever when she pronounced that sentence which could no more leave Rubashov's memory than the folded hands of the Pieta.
"You will always be able to do what you like with me," she said.
"But why?" asked Rubashov. She didn't answer.
Rubashov lived day by day and night by night in the atmosphere of her large, lazy body. Her behavior during work remained unaltered. Her voice and the expression of her eyes was the same. Never did they contain the least suggestion of an allusion. Sometimes he added sarcastic commentaries to what he was dictating. Then she stopped writing and waited, pencil in hand, until he had finished. But she never smiled at his sarcasm. Once only, after a particularly dangerous joke of Rubashov's referring to certain personal habits of number ones, she said, suddenly, in her sleepy voice, "You ought not to say such things in front of other people. You ought to be more careful altogether." It was the time of preparation for the second great trial of the opposition. The air in the legation had become peculiarly thin. Photographs and portraits disappeared from walls overnight. They had hung there for years, but now the light patches leapt to the eye. Not only the portraits on the walls, but also the shelves in the library were thinned out. The disappearance of certain books and brochures happened discreetly, usually the day after the arrival of a new message from above. New books arrived. The classics of social science appeared with new footnotes and commentaries. The old histories were replaced by new histories. The old memoirs of dead revolutionary leaders were replaced by new memoirs. An order had come from above to appoint a librarian who would take political responsibility for the contents of the legation library. They had appointed Aluva to this post. At first, Rubashov had held the whole thing for an imbecility. Up to the evening when, at the weekly meeting of the legation party cell, Aluva had been sharply attacked from several sides. Three or four speakers, amongst whom was the first secretary, rose and complained that some of the most important speeches of number one were not to be found in the library, that, on the other hand, it was still full of oppositional works, and that books by politicians who had been unmasked as spies, traitors, and agents of foreign powers had until quite recently occupied prominent positions in the shelves, so that one could hardly avoid a suspicion of an intentional demonstration. Oliver, summoned to make a statement, said with her usual equanimity that she was far from having any evil intent and that she had followed every instruction given to her. The meeting ended with the resolution to give Aluva a serious warning. Rubashov stopped making personal comments while dictating, and that gave him a singular feeling of guilt. After a week, Aluva stayed away from his room one evening and did not come the following evenings either. It was 3 days before Rubashov could bring himself to ask her the reason. She answered something about a migraine, and Rubashov did not press her any further. From then on, she did not come again, with one exception. And on that occasion, her behavior was almost as usual. But the whole evening, Rubashov had the feeling that she was waiting for him to say something decisive. He only said, however, that he was glad she was back again, and that he was overworked and tired, which actually was the case. In the night, he noticed repeatedly that she was awake and staring into the dark, and that was her last visit to him. At the next meeting of the party cell, Aluva was dismissed from her post as librarian because of political untrustworthiness on the motion of the first secretary. Rubashov, who was suffering from almost intolerable toothache, had excused himself from attending the meeting. A few days afterwards, Aluva and another member of the staff were recalled. On the afternoon of the 10th day since his arrest, Rubashov was taken to be shaved. The barber worked in silence, rapidly and carefully. When the soaping was over, after the first stroke of the razor, the barber asked whether the blade did not scratch, addressing him as Citizen Rubashov. And then there was silence again. The guard in the doorway lit a cigarette.
The barber trimmed Rubashov's goatee and head with quick, precise movements. While he stood bent over Rubashov, the latter caught his eye for a moment. In the same instant, the barber pushed two fingers under Rubashov's collar as if to reach the hair on his neck more easily. And as he drew out his fingers, Rubashov felt the scratching of a little ball of paper under his collar. A few minutes later, the operation was over and Rubashov was conducted back to his cell. He sat down on his bed, extracted the bit of paper, flattened it, and read it. It consisted of only three words. Die in silence. Rubashov threw the scrap of paper into the bucket. It was the first message which had reached him from outside. In the enemy country, he had often had messages smuggled to him in prison. They had summoned him to raise his voice in protest, to hurl accusation back at his accusers. Were there also moments in history in which the revolutionary had to keep silent? Were there turning points in history where only one thing was required of him, only one thing was right? To die in silence. Rubashov's thoughts were interrupted by number 402, who had started tapping immediately on his return. He wanted to find out where Rubashov had been taken. To be shaved, Rubashov replied. I feared the worst already, tapped number 402 back. After you, tapped back Rubashov. Ha, ha. You are a devil of a fellow, number 402 replied. Strangely enough, this archaic compliment filled Rubashov with a kind of satisfaction. He envied 402, whose caste possessed a rigid code of honor prescribing how to live and how to die. But to that one could cling. For his own kind, there was no textbook. For Rubashov, everything had to be worked out. What was more honorable? To die in silence? Or to abase oneself publicly in order to be able to pursue one's aims? He had sacrificed Oliver because his own existence was more valuable to the revolution. That was the decisive argument his friends had used to convince him. The duty to keep oneself in reserve for later on was more important than the commandments of petty bourgeois morality. You can do what you like with me, Oliver had said. And so he had done. Well, why should he treat himself with more consideration? The coming decade will decide the fate of our era, Ivanov had quoted. Could he abscond out of merely personal disgust and tiredness and vanity? And what if, after all, number one were in the right? If here in dirt and blood and lies, after all and in spite of everything, the splendid foundations of the future were being laid. Die in silence. Fade into darkness. Well, that was easily said. Rubashov stopped suddenly in the third black tile from the window. He had caught himself repeating the words, die in silence, aloud several times, in an ironically disapproving tone, as if to emphasize their full absurdity. Only now did he become aware that his decision to refuse Ivanov's offer was not half as unshakable as he had believed. Now it seemed to him even questionable whether he had ever seriously intended to reject the offer and to walk off the stage without a word. The day before the term set by Ivanov expired, at the serving out of supper, Rubashov had the feeling that there was something unusual in the air. He was unable to work, he felt tension in his nerves, as rheumatic people feel a storm. After the last post had died away, he spied out into the corridor. The electric bulbs, lacking current, burnt at half strength and shed their dim light onto the tiles. The silence of the corridor seemed more final and hopeless than ever. In spite of the late hour, he started a conversation with number 402. "Are you asleep?" he tapped. For a while there was no answer. Then it came, quieter and slower than usual. "No. Do you feel it too?" "Feel what?" Rubashov tapped back with his pince-nez. 402 hesitated a while. The silence was so thick that Rubashov heard it humming in his ears. Suddenly the wall ticked again. "Funny that you felt it at once." "Felt what?" Rubashov asked. "Explain. Tonight, political differences are being settled." "Executions?" Rubashov asked. "Yes."
"How do you know?"
"From Harelip."
"At what time?"
"Don't know. Soon."
"Do you know the names?" asked Rubashov.
"No." Rubashov lay down again and waited. He had never witnessed an execution. He vaguely knew that they were carried out at night in the cellars and that the delinquent was killed by a bullet in the neck. In the party, death had no romantic aspect. The words physical liquidation evoked only one concrete idea, the cessation of political activity. Rubashov had taken off his shoes and socks. His bare feet at the other end of the blanket stuck up palely in the darkness. Where did the physical liquidation take place? He had the idea that it must take place below, under the stairs which led down beyond the barber's shop. What did the executioner say to his victim? Perhaps he shot without warning from behind while they were walking along. Did the man fall forwards or backwards? Did he call out? Rubashov sniffed and noticed that for some time already he had the scent of aloe vera in his nostrils. The ticking in the wall started again. "They are coming." Rubashov listened, waited. The silence thickened. He took off his pince-nez and tapped. "I hear nothing." For a while, 402 did not answer. Suddenly he tapped loudly and sharply. "Number 380. Pass it on." Rubashov sat up quickly. He understood. The news had been tapped on through 11 cells by the neighbours of number 380. The occupants of the cells between 380 and 402 formed an acoustic relay through darkness and silence. Rubashov jumped from his bunk, pattered over barefooted to the other wall, and tapped to 406. "Attention. 380 is to be shot now. Pass it on." He listened. The bucket stank. There was no answer. Rubashov pattered back to the bunk. This time he tapped with his knuckles. "Who is number 380? There was again no answer. Rubashov guessed that, like himself, 402 was moving pendulum-like between the two walls of his cell. In the 11 cells beyond him, the inhabitants were hurrying noiselessly with bare feet backwards and forwards between the cells. Now 402 was back again at his wall. He announced, "They are reading the sentence to him now. He is shouting for help." "He is shouting for help," Rubashov tapped on to 406. He was afraid that the next time he went near the bucket, he would be sick. "They are bringing him. Screaming and hitting out. Pass it on," tapped number 402.
"What is his name?"
Rubashov tapped back quickly before 402 had quite finished his sentence. This time he got an answer. "Bogrov. Oppositional. Pass it on." Rubashov's legs became suddenly heavy. He leaned against the wall and tapped through to 406. "Michael Bogrov. Former sailor on battleship Potemkin, commander of the Eastern Fleet, bearer of the First Revolutionary Order led to execution. He was sick into the bucket and ended his sentence. Pass it on. Darkness at Noon by Arthur Koestler, read by John le Carré. The cell door slammed behind Rubashov. He remained leaning against it for a few seconds, lit a cigarette. On the bed to his right lay two fairly clean blankets and the straw mattress newly filled. The wash basin to his left had no plug, but the tap functioned, and the bucket beside it did not smell. The window started at eye level. You could see down into the courtyard without having to pull yourself up by the bars. He yawned, took his coat off, rolled it up, and put it on the mattress as a pillow.